Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Chickens are bred for specific purposes, just like you wouldn't want a chihuahua to go and herd your sheep, or you wouldn't want to get a Great Dane to sit and be a lap dog.
So what breeds of chickens do you get if you want them to lay a lot of eggs? Jana Wilson gives us advice today. More sunlight means hens lay more eggs. More sunlight and warmer weather also impact how maple sap flows. We speak with two local syrup producers who have seen a quick end this year's sugaring season. Then one recipe with the folks at Farm Bloomington using the sweet syrup. And we'll hear how college loan debt is forcing wannabe farmers to put their dreams on hold. Headlines from the food world. What's up, Mark Chilla?
President Donald Trump ordered new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt to formally revise the Obama administration's 2015 Clean Water Rule, which was meant to explain which rivers, streams, and creeks are subject to regulation by the EPA. The American Farm Bureau Federation and its many state-level counterparts pushed to change the rule, saying it was a federal overreach onto farmers' land, and contending that the rule would allow the agency to dictate how farmers use certain bodies of water on farmland. Many environmental groups, however, say the rule is necessary to combat water pollution, especially water pollution caused by farms and ranches. Trump's executive order directs the new EPA administrator to revise it, which could take years. Philadelphia-area soda distributors and grocers are reporting a 50% drop in sugar-sweetened beverage sales so far this year. That's after the city council voted last summer to implement a 1.5 cent per ounce soda tax aimed at curbing sales of unhealthy drinks while generating revenue for the city infrastructure and education projects. The price of a 12-pack of cans has now doubled, but technically the levy is assessed at the distributor level, so it's not a tax, and it's up to them whether or not to pass that cost on to their customers. Canada Dry Delaware Valley Chief Operating Officer Bob Brockway, who distributes more than 20% of all soft drinks in the Philadelphia market, told Bloomberg that he expects his business will decline by at least a third over the course of the year, and layoffs are likely. Experts say it's too early to tell the long-term effects of the tax in Philadelphia, but it's likely consumers will start buying soda again once they're used to the new prices. And the CEO of Kind Healthy Snacks, Daniel Lebetsky, has pledged $25 million to fund a new initiative called Feed the Truth, which aims to fight the food industry's influence on public health and scientific research. The initiative will tackle issues like misleading and conflicting health guidelines and standards. In May 2015, the nutritional value of Kind products was called into question by the FDA. The agency claimed Kind's products did not meet the standards required to be labeled as healthy. The FDA later reversed the decision. Feed the Truth will be steered by a team of public health advocates and policy analysts. Visit our website to read more about these stories and then share them with your friends. Tell them you found us at eartheats.org.
Okay, Mark, till next time.
See you then.
$1 trillion. That's the massive hole of student debt that Americans are trying to climb out of. After college, many graduates are postponing their dream careers to pay off some of their loans. That's especially the case for many young people trying to start their own farm. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
On a chilly, cloudy morning in central Missouri, Liz Graysneck pulls weeds from a bed of recently planted spinach with help from her four-year-old daughter, Sylvia.
Nope, those aren't weeds.
Several rows of leafy greens run the length of a large, rounded greenhouse called a high tunnel, protected from the elements.
That guy's the spinach. We don't want to take that one up, okay?
Today, Graysneck sells organic produce to nearby restaurants and at farmers markets. But 8 years ago, before she started Happy Hollow Farm, it was hard to see this success. While on track to earn a PhD in plant breeding, Graysneck fell in love with the concept and community of farming local produce. She decided then that instead of studying plants, she wanted to grow them. No problem.
The mortgage aside, it costs a hell of a lot of money to start a farm. and to build the infrastructure and to buy drip tape and row cover and hoops and, I mean, just everything that you could imagine.
So, just like many other businesses, you go to a bank, take out a loan, and buy some property. Well, not so easy on a grad student salary.
No bank was going to give me a loan at making $8 an hour. Like, no way. And owing, you know, 30-some-odd thousand dollars in student loans. So that's why I got a job.
After graduating with a master's, Graysneck ended up deferring her student loan payments, interning on several farms, and then working full-time at a garden center so she could save up enough money to launch her dream farm. And she did, 6 years later. It's an inescapable fear in the Midwest. Who is going to grow the food in the future? The average age of American farmers, 58 in 2012, keeps ticking upward, and there aren't enough new or young farmers entering the evolving field.
I think it really is an increasing concern.
Kevin Moore is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri. He teaches a class for students called Returning to the Farm. The students crunch the numbers to figure out a business plan and the economic reality of what it will take to farm successfully, whether it's a small operation or a larger, more conventional farm.
The capital requirement of agriculture has continued to increase, which makes it more difficult for a young person to get in and to get to the adequate size that's kind of required to be efficient and competitive.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has farm loan programs to help fill that gap for new farmers, but the funding is limited by Congress, and no one knows how the new administration will treat loan guarantee programs. Lindsay Lushershute is with the National Young Farmers Coalition. Her group has another idea. It's turned into a bill in the U.S. House called the Young Farmers Success Act.
And that would be to add farmers to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
By adding full-time farmers to the program, which typically includes less profitable public service jobs like teaching, young people with student debt who commit to farming for a decade are eligible to make monthly income-based payments for 10 years, after which they qualify for loan forgiveness.
We want also this as a way to recruit young people into the field of agriculture, to say, as a nation, thank you for being out in the field and pursuing this really noble career.
Turning the bill into a law is a long shot. But Shute says she's hopeful it will get a serious look by Congress.
That's a weed, yeah, sweetheart. That one is. You could pull that one. That one's called chickweed, babe.
Organic farmer Liz Graysneck has since paid off her student loans. She says even though she had to work for a few years to start her farm, she did more than save money. She learned construction, plumbing, electricity, soil science, all skills needed to launch a successful farm.
Somehow people have to learn those skills, and if you don't have the opportunity to grow up learning those skills, then how are you going to learn them?
She says she, along with many other farmers, hopes that there will be someone to take over the farm when she gets older, maybe even her daughter. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest has reporters located all over the Midwest and in the Rocky Mountains. They compile stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. A couple weeks ago, we had Jana Wilson on the show to talk about those things she wished she'd known before she started a backyard chicken farm some 16 years ago. Today, I wanted to ask her about the good stuff, all the eggs your chickens are going to lay for you. Are Sicilian buttercups good egg layers?
Well, that's an interesting question. Mine are. When you look at the literature, they're only listed as like good, not very good or excellent. But they're also listed as non-sitters. And my Sicilian buttercups are the best layers I have. They lay.
She breeds chickens like Sicilian buttercups on her farm. So she's created a flock of good layers thanks to generations of careful breeding. She saw the first egg of the season way back on January 1st, believe it or not. And now, as we get more and more daylight, her hens are laying more and more eggs. And it's nice to have an expert like Jana on speed dial because I get to ask questions that I've always wondered about, like that little tiny spot of blood that you can sometimes get in a yolk. What's the deal with that?
It's totally fine. It has nothing to do with the egg. There's nothing wrong with the egg. It just happens that while the egg is being formulated inside of the hen, there might be a little rupture of a blood vessel in the area in which, you know, where the yolk is. There's just a little tiny rupture of the blood vessel while the egg's being formed. And then the shell is created around that yolk and egg white and the little blood spots in there. But the egg is not fertile. It's not dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's just purely a little accident and very safe.
Well, the other thing I notice about these particular eggs that I have, I know they're from chickens that roam free, that are on forage, that are just able to be chickens. The yolks are just the most gorgeous, bright orange, and they're so firm. So what can you tell me about what the chicken's eating to give me that kind of egg?
Well, and it is. It really is what they eat that decides the appearance of the yolk. When chickens are free ranging, they have access to a lot of greens and grass, bugs, things like that. And there is a chemical in especially grass that causes the yolks to turn a dark, bright orange or dark yellow. And the same chemical, you can find it in perhaps lesser degrees in other ingredients like corn, marigolds, pumpkins, anything that's orange in terms of food. But it's called xanthanol, and in the grass, it's very strong. And so you can pretty much always tell. I can tell when I look at an egg, I can tell if that chicken was free ranged.
And they taste better. I think they taste better. Is it all in my head?
Well, you know, I'm going to say it depends. Honestly, I think that I can tell a difference, too, when I, you know, have an egg that's come from the grocery store in a large production facility versus my own eggs and my chickens who are free range. So I can tell the difference, too.
Okay, but yeah. Sometimes I've heard that chickens can lay eggs with soft shells.
Mm-hmm.
When does that happen? Why does that happen?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a really funny looking thing. It looks like a big water balloon, like a little water balloon, you know. It's shaped like an egg, but you touch it and it goes in and out, in and out. You know, it's really not a big deal. A lot of times, if a young pullet, who's a hen less than a year, if a young pullet is just starting to lay eggs, her system hasn't regulated itself yet. And so perhaps not enough calcium is deposited to make a hard shell. So there may be one or two soft-shelled eggs. The same can be said to happen with older hens at the end of their laying life or their laying cycle, even for the year. Once again, the system's not working on all cylinders, and so there's not enough calcium.
When we're
deposited.
Talking about old chickens, how old are we talking? How many years?
You know, it's said that pretty much a hen between 2 and 3 years of age is at her peak laying years.
Oh.
But it's just simply something in the system that's just not working quite right. But it usually is a temporary thing. Mm-hmm. If you're concerned and if you see it happen a lot, you can do a couple of things. Usually people should be feeding their laying hens what's called a layer feed. And that feed is formulated for hens knowing that they'll use extra calcium. So they add extra calcium to that laying feed. So you should look for that when you're at the store and buying feed for your laying hens. They do need a special feed. And the other thing is you can buy something called crushed oyster shell. And you can just leave it in a container or a bowl around the coop or the pen, and they can just peck at it whenever they want. And that actually has a lot of calcium in it as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if we want egg-laying breeds, mm-hmm. what sort of breeds should we be looking for?
Chickens are bred for specific purposes, just like you wouldn't want a Chihuahua to go and herd your sheep, or you wouldn't want to get a Great Dane to sit and be a lap dog. I'd say my top five in terms of the best egg-laying breeds are Leghorns. They're usually the number one. But remember, their personalities are a little kooky, and they're flighty, and they're not super calm. So you have to think about what it is you want in your backyard. A little calmer, Rhode Island Reds, super good egg layers. Buff Orpingtons,
mm-hmm.
Australorps, wonderful. They're all a little calmer, and they're pretty good egg layers. And then finally, there's something called a sex-link hybrid. I started out my very first six chickens 16 years ago were called American Red Stars. And they were a sex-link hybrid, which simply means when you put together certain combinations of breeds, the females and the males come out and they're different colors.
Oh, and that's handy.
Yes, it is handy. And they're very, very good egg layers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're not of a breed if you are interested in preserving heritage breeds. That's not perhaps the chicken for you. I'll put a plug in for heritage breeds.
Yeah, please do.
So some of my favorites are the Hamburg. There's a silver spangled and a gold spangled Hamburg. Campine, they're very pretty. The Holland, that's an American breed too.
Mm-hmm.
And the Red Cap, that's a breed from England originally. And you can get them in catalogs. I've seen them. They're still available if you want to order them. But they're all very good egg layers, and they're also somewhat endangered. So there's a plug for the heritage breeds that need some help.
One more question. I put my eggs in the fridge. And I've heard differing opinions on this. Where do you stand on whether or not to refrigerate your eggs?
Well, let me give you the two points of view.
Okay.
In the United States, the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, requires that egg producers wash and sanitize their eggs before they are packed away and sent off in refrigerated trucks to the refrigerated sections of the grocery store. So when you're in the United States, you'll always see eggs in the refrigerated section. Mm-hmm. So the whole reason they wash eggs in the United States is to prevent the transmission of salmonella,
sure,
for one, right?
Sure.
So in the United Kingdom especially, they do not wash their eggs. They believe that by washing the eggs, if it's done at the incorrect temperature especially, eggshells are actually porous. And if you don't have the correct temperatures, the eggshell, the egg inside can contract, it can pull in germs. And there's also something called a bloom that coats the egg when it comes out of the hen, and that is washed off. So the thinking in the European countries is that this bloom and not washing the eggs will keep the eggs protected from salmonella. Also in Europe, many farmers vaccinate their chickens against salmonella. Now, if you have eggs and you have refrigerated them ever at all, you can't leave them out. You can't say, oh, they've been in the refrigerator, but I'm going to leave them out. Because you have, especially if you have American eggs that have been washed completely off, when they come out of the refrigerator, if you let them go to room temperature, they will. Have you ever noticed if you left an egg out, they sweat? They get little beads of moisture on them.
Yeah.
Well, that's bad because it can allow some bacteria and germs to get inside the egg.
Oh.
So where I stand is, I refrigerate my eggs if I'm going to keep them for a long period of time. When I gather them immediately from the coop, I try to gather my eggs on a regular basis so they don't get dirty. I will bring them inside, and they may sit on the counter for a day or so, but they do eventually go in the refrigerator. They do keep longer that way. Mm. At my house, eggs never stay very long, however, so.
Jana Wilson has been raising chickens and ducks for about 16 years on her land in rural Monroe County. Her chicken advice is on our website, yes, and it's also featured in our new book, which we're really, really excited about. You can pre-order that through Indiana University Press. Okay, Jana, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, warm weather means the maple sap harvest in Indiana is basically over. We hear from two producers who are dealing with a less than stellar season. Oh, hey, did you know that we podcast? You can subscribe for free to our weekly feed and listen to Earth Eats on your own time. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. But that word, podcasts, what does it mean? How do you do it? This month, we're joining podcast producers of all stripes in challenging you to get the word out about podcasting. Tell a friend about your favorite podcast, and then tell us about it on Twitter using the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Hi, I'm Annie. I visited Amran Ahmad at Bradford Woods in February, and it was 67 degrees that day. I was in short sleeves, but Amran, who's originally from Malaysia, was wearing a fleece and a knit cap.
I mean, this is I love this weather. I just love to see the different season. Yeah, so that's why I like Indiana.
He's an environmental education assistant director at Bradford Woods. February is supposed to be prime sugaring time in Indiana. Looking around the 2,500-acre property, you see that some 30 maple trees have been tapped, and there are blue plastic bags hanging from the spiles. We're walking around looking for another maple tree to tap, one that's big enough to handle giving up some of its sap and has successfully healed over last year's tap site.
We have, this one over here is a good healing. You can see that.
That was last year's?
This is last year's, yes. So I think we're gonna tap these trees over here. You wanna do this one, Jen?
Sure, that works.
Okay.
Jen Smith is also an environmental education assistant director. She says they have about 90 gallons of sap stored up, and they plan to boil that down into syrup with the kids who attend their annual maple syrup camp in March. This season, on really good days, they were emptying the blue bags twice a day. Sap runs its best when you have sub-freezing temperatures overnight and 40s during the day. But as we almost break a sweat on this mid-February afternoon, Jen says the sugaring season is basically over for them.
Yeah, I feel like this year it's been really unique weather. You know, usually, you know, how often do you walk around in shorts in February? And I'm in shorts, and I've already started to see buds on trees. I've seen daffodils starting to come up.
The buds tell us a lot about what's going on inside the tree, but more on that in a minute. Bradford Woods is small potatoes when you compare it to a commercial operation like Harris Sugar Bush in Putnam County, Indiana.
A good day's run, we'll gather 5,000, 6,000, sometimes 8,000 gallons of sugar water a day when it runs good.
Arthur Harris has 6,000 taps and 28 miles of tubing on his farm. That morning when he and I spoke, he and his wife were bottling their maple syrup.
And the warm weather has caused the holes to dry up and the freeze-thaw cycle has stopped, so we're done till next year.
He describes the freeze-thaw process like this. When it gets below freezing overnight, the tree shrinks and pulls in water from the ground, just like sucking water through a straw. When the sun comes up and that warm air hits the tree expands and the sap is pushed throughout the tree. That's when he harvests the sap. But looking ahead a couple days, temperatures are going to drop back down to the freezing mark overnight. Arthur explains, though, that they've already passed the point of no return.
When the air temperature's been like it has in the last week, 10 days, where it's 60, 70, that tree decides it's time to swell the buds and make leaves. Well, the chemical process in that tree will change the structure of the sap so that that bud now knows that it is to make leaves. It's a signal. And when it swells and starts that process, even if it went back to freeze-thaw, that sap is no longer any good to make syrup out of. Fact is, when you boil it, it smells so bad you cannot stand the smell. Well, that tree now is saying, okay, I'm done giving you sap. We're going to make leaves.
He's made maple syrup most of his life. He's turning 65 this April. So he's watched the weather patterns over the years. A few years ago, he had a great season with a full crop. Last year, his production was down by half, and this year looks like it'll be down by a third. And that mirrors what other Indiana maple syrup operations are experiencing. According to a Department of Natural Resources survey, producers made a whopping 22,400 gallons of syrup in 2013. But then that dropped to 14,700 the next year, down even more in 2015, and then in 2016, statewide production ticked up slightly to just over 12,000 gallons of syrup. With all the uncertainty in sugaring these days, they've started diversifying their farm. They now run a hardwood sawmill. They also design and sell the vacuum systems that they hook up to maple trees.
And we're prepared for these seasons. You have to be. You can't put all your eggs in one basket. It's too expensive. It's very expensive to operate. And the expense is the same whether you make a little or a lot.
Back with Amran and Jen at Bradford Woods. We're tapping this tree anyway. Amran picks the side that gets the most sunlight, and he measures 4 or 5 inches away from last year's tap site. He has a drill with pink tape on the bit to show him how deep to go.
Typically what we're going to do, we're going to angle it just a little bit. Okay, so and then spout, tap it. There you go, I'll stop.
Now we got the aluminum bucket, and then we have the cover as well. So in case it rains, it won't dilute our sap.
And so as you can see it right now.
It's already coming out. Oh my gosh.
There you go.
This is the first drip.
You talk about the magic of maple syrup. That first dink is usually what gets me every time.
The forecast that day was for another warm night, so despite our instant gratification, Jen wasn't expecting much more than a half inch of sap in this bucket by the morning. Check out pictures I snapped at Bradford Woods on our website, and if you want to learn about the maple syrup programs they offer, visit bradwoods.org. And how about a recipe that really lets the sweetness of maple syrup shine through? Daniel Orr is pairing it with a root vegetable that's probably still gracing tables at winter farmers markets.
Well, turnips are great to just simply boil. You can grate the turnips and make turnip and potato pancakes. They come out much moister, they're less starchy. You can make turnip soups, you can use them in chicken soup. You know, toss them in where you'd use carrots. In France, they have what they call a navarin, and usually made with lamb, spring lamb with baby turnips, which is really nice. So, yeah, they're great in those kind of, you know, stick-to-the-bone stews and meals like that.
So these turnips, they're pretty. They've got a little purple to them.
Purple tops and white bottoms. And we're going to leave the skin on them. I'm just going to cut the tops and bottoms off of them and then cut them into kind of bite-sized pieces. All right, so we've got three turnips, and this will feed about six people, this recipe. So I'm going to put a little bit of apple juice in the pan. You could use apple cider. And what that's going to do is give you a little bit of sweetness. Okay, and we're going to add a couple pears to that, about the same size cut. And it's good to use a Basque-style pear, or this is an Anjou pear. You want to use something that's a little firm. You don't want it to be too ripe. If it was too ripe, it's just going to turn to mush in the pan while it cooks. Okay, and we're gonna just kind of cook those until they start to get tender. I'm gonna go ahead and add my grade A maple syrup, which has a really nice, elegant flavor. Grade B maple syrup will be a little darker, maybe a little bit thicker, and a little more aggressive flavor. What we wanna do is to reduce all those liquids down until it forms kind of a glaze that enrobes the pears and the turnips. And then we're going to finish it with a little bit of butter and lemon juice. So that will kind of round it all out. And what you're looking for whenever, we've talked about this before, are kind of those five senses. You want to taste a little sweet, a little bitter, a little salt, a little richness, a little acidity. So when you're asking yourself, what's this dish missing? You know, kind of go through those five flavor profiles and then you can adjust accordingly. Okay, we'll just put a little bit of chopped herbs on it. And that is our ragu of parsnips and pears with maple syrup and sweet seasoned spices.
Find the recipe at eartheats.org. Thanks to Daniel Orr and everyone at Farm Bloomington for all their great recipes. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm your host and producer, Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.